What's up, pod people? Welcome back to another episode. I am James Reinhart.
And I am Justin Morgan.
And Justin, I think you have some current events to share.
The current events, I guess what's going on most recently would probably be the Halloween news that Jamie Lee Curtis is coming back.
Yeah, the big news broke this weekend, I think, wasn't it? Or is it Friday?
Somewhere around shortly, a couple days ago.
Yeah.
A week ago from whenever this comes out, probably.
Yeah, but they announced a Halloween reboot, which David Gordon Green is directing, which he co-wrote with Danny McBride. It's officially announced it will be titled Halloween. Jamie Lee Curtis will be returning. And it will not acknowledge any of the sequels. It will just pick up where the first one left off. So
it's just part two.
Part two.
I was a little confused. Because I thought it might have been part three or something. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested to see whatever the hell it is. Everyone's back. Carpenter's back.
Yeah, Carpenter is scoring it, and he's producing it. I remember when you and I were texting, I said, I'm worried that Carpenter is going to pass away before he can score. And you're like, way to escalate, James.
Yeah, that was a... He's not that... Well, all his counterparts that have passed away recently have died younger.
Mm-hmm.
But by all means, he should have, like, another 20 years.
I think what's helping Carpenter is he's staying active. Like, he's still doing music. He's still touring. Like, he's writing comic books. Like, he's still, like, keeping himself engaged. And I think that's what's kind of keeping him going, which is good.
I hope you're right.
I hope, yeah. I'm looking forward to it, though. You know, I love Halloween. And I'm curious to see what they have to do with this new one.
Anything new with you?
Not a damn thing. If you folks are in the Pittsburgh area, come check out Scare House, one of the premier haunted houses around here. I will be working there. And, come say hi.
Are you in the basement?
I'm not. No, I'm a pretty terrible actor, so I'm front of the house. I'm customer service guy.
I wouldn't even say that you have to be the greatest actor. You just have to be able to touch people.
That's true. Well, when I... When I was interviewing with them, they asked me if I was interested in working in the basement, and I realized I don't want to spend my evenings groping strangers. So that's, yeah.
Why not? That's what I'm feeling, right? Why not?
For those of you who don't know, this haunted house, this scare house, has a section called the basement where you have to sign a waiver to go in, and the actors are allowed to touch you and all that stuff. I went through the basement at our dress rehearsal this year. And it's actually really good this year. It's really fun, but it's less touchy and more of an immersive theater experience. It's much more intense than a normal haunt. And while they can touch you, they're trying to refrain from that and do more of this like kind of intense survival situation.
I've only been there one time, and I went with Cooper, who I worked with on the TV show Banshee.
Mm-hmm.
And Cooper got stabbed in the eye with a fork. By one of the actors, like, they got, like, the corner of his eye.
What?
And the character, yeah, they broke character to apologize to him.
Oh, shit.
But it was a really, really weird experience, because it was me, him, and Steph.
Mm.
We went to the regular haunted house, and we were going to the basement. And University of Pittsburgh was there,
mm-hmm.
and they were doing a study on how fear affects people. Steph didn't want to do it, but me and Cooper were like, okay, we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we went in this little room where they fitted this brain wavelength thing on both of our heads that was all wet. And they put us in a little... They put these lab coats on us with heart monitors and all kind of weird shit. So we went into this little room, and it was a computer screen. Mm-hmm. And it was going to start showing us stuff, and we were just, you know, fill whatever we had to... Whatever mm-hmm. we felt. And it would be things like a cute dog. And then it would be, like, a dead animal.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a happy family. And then it would get, like, pornographic. Like, here's gay sex. And it would just keep showing you, like, something very explicit, something not so much. And then we went through after that video, we went through the scare house basement.
Mm-hmm.
And they monitored where we went and how we felt through the whole thing. And we had to go do that video one more time when we finished. And they said they were going to email us and let us know of our results about anything that they found interesting about us. And I never got anything.
Hmm.
I was thinking that I was a sociopath. I'm like, they're going to be like, this guy is not reacting to normal things.
You know, I remember one of my coworkers at Scare House telling me that there was a woman who'd been working with them for a few years who was a sociologist, and she was doing a study on fear, and she's writing a book on it. So that might have been part of that. I don't think she's involved with us this year, though.
If you can get her information, the year would be the year that Krampus came out.
Oh, okay.
Find out if she does write a book, whatever the hell she writes. I'm interested in reading it. I want to know if I'm a part of it.
You want to know if where
one
you
fucked up soul named Justin. Justin, we won't say his last name, Morgan. He's really fucked up. This is what he enjoys, but I never got any of
maybe,
that.
I'm sure they'll tell us once that book comes out, but I'll see what I can find out. But yeah, folks, that was my weekend, last weekend, and if you're looking for a good time, and hopefully not to get stabbed in the eye, apparently, come by a Scare House and say hi.
And I just wanted to talk briefly about, I went to the movies, as I sometimes do.
As we do.
And I end up seeing Darren Aronofsky's Mother, which I will say that I'm one of the few, but I absolutely love that movie. People were like, why? Are you depraved? Well, yeah, I just talked about my study about how I probably am and have problems. But a few weeks ago, me and James were talking about the Twin Peaks wrap-up. I know this is very niche at the moment, but if you're a fan of David Lynch and you really liked the new Twin Peaks, I honestly think that Mother is something that you might enjoy. It's very subjective, but the thing that I absolutely loved about the movie, and I was talking to James about it a little bit earlier, is I feel like Darren Aronofsky had a really, really bad experience with guests before he wrote this movie, because it's really about guests, like, these guests disobey the homeowners and their wishes, and nothing crazy, like, please don't smoke in the house, and it just keeps coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Don't sit on that. It's not braced at the wall, and people keep doing it. And the escalation kind of grows and grows and grows. But it does get insane the last couple 30 minutes or so. There is something that's really, really hard to watch, and I think that's what's probably really dividing people, not how ambiguous it is. Usually you get these ambiguous movies, and people are just pissed because they want a definitive answer.
Yeah.
You're not going to get it. So if it sounds like you hate this movie already, don't see it. But if you're intrigued by maybe some of the Lynchian aspects I was talking about, I definitely go check it out.
Yeah, I have not seen it. I want to. I don't know if I'm going to see it in theaters. And as I was telling you earlier, one of my coworkers today told me that he saw it over the weekend and said that he was considering walking out of the movie, but he stuck through the end hoping that they would explain to him what the hell was going on, and it didn't.
There you go. The explanation is... Mm-hmm. But I think it's more... the thing I like about these movies are it seems a little more fun that you get to piece it together. I was reading something on the Washington Post where they had an analogy for Mother Earth that fit. They had one that was, you know, biblical, Old Testament that fit. Like, all these little things were all kind of fitting perfectly, and they were kind of different ideas altogether, too.
Hmm. Well, once I see it, I will offer my opinions.
I think that's fun. Maybe down the road we can do something when we do directors or something. I'd love to do Aronofsky.
Yeah, I'd love to revisit.
Torture everybody. Be like, we're going to watch every Aronofsky movie ever and talk about it.
Do you want to feel really depressed? It's Aronofsky month.
Yeah, actually, you're pretty much right. It's the depression you will get.
Let's do it.
Well, we are back with Stephen King again. This is our fifth episode out of seven.
Yeah, it's our King Marathon, and this is a fun week, I guess. This is a bad Stephen King.
I might have to take that back a little bit, because I've had more fun with the second movie than I thought I would, or of what I remembered.
Of Cat's Eye?
Yeah, Cat's Eye was not as bad as I remembered it to be.
Yeah, I was going to say, Cat's Eye, there's something kind of endearing about that movie. Like, it's not great, but I enjoyed it a lot more than Maximum Overdrive.
Well, I did watch Maximum Overdrive and then watch Cat's Eye almost immediately after, like an hour or so after.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like it could win an Academy Award when I was done with that. Yeah.
But yeah. King, you know, obviously he is heralded as a great storyteller. You know, he's best-selling author, multiple film adaptations, legions of fans. But I feel like if you're a guy like him, as prolific as him, that keeps putting out stuff, you're gonna put out, you're bound to put out some stinkers. And there have been some bad King adaptations, been some good King adaptations. And these two are, I guess I say Maximum Overdrive is definitely, like, when you think bad King, that is like the bad Stephen King.
There are some other ones. What was it? Golden Years. There's been some really bad, hard to watch King adaptations.
Yeah, a lot of the TV stuff, like The Stand.
I mean, out of everything that we've done so far, I'll backtrack a little bit. Dark Tower, I hated it. Salem's Lot, I loved it. 1408 was something Chuck chose that I felt that I should enjoy it way more than I did, but I didn't hate it. I guess that's the okay spectrum for me.
I couldn't make that episode because I saw 1408 in theaters. I remember really enjoying it, and I was curious to see if it held up because I haven't seen it since.
Well, the one that I watched was not the theatrical one, and nothing said that it wasn't, and I really thought they didn't go subtle when they should have went subtle.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that if they just toyed around with it, it would have made it so much better. And the end of the theatrical one that I remember that was subtle, after they can't prove if he did experience or not, on his tape recorder, he recorded his daughter and him and his ex-wife hear it, or current wife hear it. And they had this, like, kind of all shit moment.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes everything that happened before relevant.
Mm-hmm.
In the director's cut or whatever the hell I watched, Samuel Jackson shows up at his funeral and he listens to the tape. And then, in case you weren't sure if John Cusack was dead, it cuts back to John Cusack as a transparent ghost in a burnt up 1408 room.
Hmm.
Of the version I just watched, it wasn't that good.
Yeah.
Of what I remember from when it came out.
Yeah. I never saw the director's cut, but I think I liked the theatrical ending better. But, I guess we should start with Maximum Overdrive.
Just take one step back real quick. I think that what we're doing that's kind of interesting with King so far is that it's been almost kind of back and forth between good and bad, or it's not like his best. Because we could have jumped on the best Stephen King. I think I'm making weird noise through my stomach. We could have just jumped for what we find to be the absolute best and just patted Stephen King on the back. Yeah. So it's nice to move into Maximum Overdrive where it's kind of really hard to pat this guy on the back.
Yeah, and Maximum Overdrive looks and feels like a film directed by a sentient bag of cocaine. And by King's own admission, he was coked out of his mind the entire time making this film. And I was reading about it. I guess the story behind it was King was unhappy with adaptations of his work, and he decided that if you want something done right, do it yourself. So he decided to adapt his own short story, Trucks, into a film, and he would write it and direct it.
And he didn't prove any points.
Yeah, he tried. I mean, God bless him for, you know, trying. But yeah, I think he decided to leave the filmmaking to the filmmakers after that.
Let's start something that's really hard. What? Tell me something good about Maximum Overdrive.
It's hard. I don't know. Like, I guess Emilio Estevez is all right.
One of my favorite things is with Emilio Estevez. It's where he just had sex, and the woman that he's with says that he makes love like a hero. I was like, I always knew Emilio Estevez made love like a hero, and now confirmed.
I really hope that, like, I don't know what his personal life is, but it'd be amazing if he, like, had a one-night stand with someone who happened to be a Maximum Overdrive fan, and they said that to him in bed. And, like, I wonder if he'd even know what they're referencing, or if he's just like, yeah, it's kind of a weird thing to say.
I would hope he didn't remember it at all. Yeah. And just like, and he probably just took it as a compliment. Like, hell yeah,
I'm a hero.
Little weird, doesn't make a lot of sense, but yeah.
Whatever. I mean, like, if I slept with Emilio Estevez, I'd definitely say that to him.
And I like, too, just that scene specifically, like, after they had sex and they go in to see Emilio Estevez, the girl that's, like, with him, he has, like, all these, like, porn photos all over the wall. So whatever this girl's attraction to Emilio Estevez was not his personality, apparently. It was the good Emilio Estevez genes.
Yeah, I guess. Do you ever watch How I Met Your Mother?
No.
There's a one character, Neil Patrick Harris' character Barney. He's like a huge womanizer, and he has all these tactics in mind for after sleep of women, how to get them to leave his apartment as quick as possible. And one of the tactics is that he has like a shelf of porn like in full view. It has it like professionally lit, just to like try to like scare. So maybe that's Emilio Estevez's game in this movie, is thinking that like maybe his porn on his wall will scare women away.
Well, what is the plot of Maximum Overdrive?
Oh, man, it is it's weird. So Earth passes through the tail of a comet, and there's like an opening scroll, Star Wars style, that like explains all this. So Earth is in the tail of this comet for like 8 days.
X amount of hours, minutes, and seconds.
Yeah, it gives you the hours, minutes, and seconds that Earth will be in the tail of this comet, and evidently this is affecting all the machines on Earth, causing them to just turn on humanity, and also like kind of have a sense of humor about it too, because like you get this title card explaining what's happening, but then it shows like the one sign to start saying like fuck you, and then Stephen King cameos going to the ATM starts calling him an asshole. So like these machines,
and he way overacts.
Yeah, Stephen King's acting is good lord. He's like, honey, this machine's calling me an asshole.
Yeah, he says it's so weird, like, King doesn't talk like that.
Yeah.
So, everything that seems to be... It doesn't really have any rules, I guess, to whether it's electronic or has an engine of some sort. I'm assuming the sprinklers that come on during the movie were triggered by, like, some electric timer, I'm assuming. Either that, it controls water too. It was just not very clear on that.
Yeah.
If you don't like children, one gets rolled over by steamroller.
That might be my favorite scene in the movie, where these kids are at this Little League game, and a pop. There's my Pittsburgh coming through. A soda machine starts spitting out soda cans at these kids, and then a steamroller breaks on it, comes onto the Little League field, and runs a kid over.
It kills the coach, which I'm actually surprised that Coke allowed this in the movie, since Coca-Cola literally is killing people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's firing off cans like bullets, which actually kind of reminds me of a movie we're not going to talk about in this streak, which is the Tommyknockers.
I've actually never seen the Tommyknockers.
Tommyknockers has a fucking hilarious scene with, I don't remember if it's a Coke machine. I feel like it's a Coke machine. It's definitely a beverage machine. And these two guys are having this conversation, and the guy's like, you want a Coke? And he's like, yeah, I definitely want a Coke. We had a hard day. And the guy goes, he puts his change in, and he goes to get the Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And his hand gets stuck in the machine, like it grabs his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy turns around, and he looks, the guy with his hand stuck in the machine, turns around, looks at the other guy, and he just screams like, it's gonna blow! And I don't know how he knows this. It explodes like a nuke went off. Like,
oh my god.
It blows up so much area. I have no idea how he knew it was going to explode, but it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
That's amazing. I've never seen that one. Wasn't that a miniseries or was that a movie?
It was definitely a miniseries of some sort. It's one of the best scenes I've ever seen ever.
It's going to blow. I'm going to see if I can find this on YouTube.
I think I have it on. I feel like I have it on DVD for some reason. I'll let you borrow it.
Oh, thank you.
But Maximum Overdrive, it has so many weird things going on in this movie.
You mentioned how like you don't know why Coke agreed, and I think I don't know how a lot of this like product placement got in this movie, because it's like part of the plot is these people are stuck at this truck stop, and all the trucks are alive and circling the truck stop, and the lead truck, I guess, it's a toy truck. It's like a truck for a toy company, but it has like a giant green goblin head from Green Goblin from Marvel Comics on like the front of it.
Yeah, like the legit Green Goblin. Yeah, like, no question about it.
Yeah, it is. And then there's like, because there's even like a Green Goblin Jack in the Box in the back of the truck in one scene.
And then I'm assuming there's a clown on the back. I'm assuming it's a Pennywise reference, because he would have been writing the book around the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of odd vehicles. There's one cart that has a machine gun on it that is so weird and doesn't make any sense as to where the hell that would have come from. It doesn't even look like a thing the military would have actually ever used.
Yeah. And then not to mention that AC/DC does the score, and in the opening scene where this bridge is like going haywire, there's a giant AC/DC truck that is kept, like there's a van with AC/DC on the side of it, and it's very prominent in this attack scene.
I'm wondering if it was like, I don't know if my times matched up, but I don't know if it was like, oh, Flash Gordon with Queen, we're definitely going to do an all AC/DC track.
Yeah, I was reading about that, because I was fascinated as to how this movie came to be, and I guess King was a big AC/DC fan, so he, like, begged them to do the score for the movie.
And not only that, but AC/DC's, like, referenced by characters randomly, too. It's not just the music playing.
Yeah. I feel like King was like, not only will I put your music in, I will, like, kiss your ass in this film.
There's, like, a Highway to Hell reference or something, and there's a lot of Hell's Bells, I think. There's so many weird references.
Yeah, it really is, like, a weird two-hour AC/DC music video.
I think, I don't know if they really get anything right. Everything's so weird. There's one character who's just obsessed with the We Made You. And she says it, like, 30 times and keeps running out to, like, scream it at the machines.
Yeah.
Is it Emilio Estevez that has the idea about the sailboat?
I think it's him, yeah.
His idea is to escape on a sailboat, which, again, makes no sense because there's also motorized boats.
Mm-hmm.
You think that would be able to take out that sailboat.
And doesn't he mention that there's, like, an island somewhere? Like, a deserted... That's where it could go, is, like, this deserted island and...
I guess that's his assumption, but there's so many weird scenes. Like, right before they get to the dock, there's a character that tries to take a wedding band off. Well, he does. He's fascinated with the wedding band for so long, he doesn't even realize that the Green Goblin truck snuck up. Like, it's not a quiet truck either, but it somehow snuck up on him. You get a few people getting crushed by these trucks.
Yeah, like you said, there's weird characters. There's, like, a... Like, Pat Hingle plays the owner of the truck stop, and he is, like, one of the most cartoonishly evil characters in cinema history.
Bubba.
Yeah, where at the beginning you see him, and, you know, Emilio Estevez is like, so wait, I'm working 9 hours, but you're only paying me for 8? And Pat Hingle's like, yeah, that's right! And, like, just this really over-the-top, like, ridiculously evil guy who's, like, threatening the, you know... Emilio Estevez is an ex-con... And that's how, like, you know, that's why Pat Hingle's underpaying him.
I like the lead actress, too. How she just, for no reason, just really understood astronomy and knew that they were in the tail of a comet for X amount of days and assumed this is what was causing everything.
Yeah, she drew that line really fast. She's like, it's probably that.
It's probably that comet that's going on right now.
Yeah, there's that, and then, another thing that got me was when, like, all this shit is going down. Like, and one character who works at truck stops, like, oh, I'm going to go out and look for my son. His son was one of the kids in the Little League game who escaped, who's also, like, one of the worst actors I've ever seen. But he's like, I'm going to look for my son. And he's, like, leaving. And Pat Hingle's like, no, wait a minute. If you clock out, then you clock out for good. And I'm like, really? Like, the world is ending, and this guy is still like, no, I'm going to run my business.
The kid, too, is funny because there's a scene where, some burger sign, just like Burger King menu sign, starts alerting that here the humans are.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, I don't even know how machines hear because they don't have ears.
Yeah.
But it's alerting them, and the kid decides to machine gun the thing down, which I kind of like the kid having a machine gun too, because it kind of reminded me of, you know, King's Dark Tower series, where it's like the kid was just as much of a team player as anybody else.
Yeah.
And kind of follows in a lot of other King stuff. But then he has this really fucking bad line where he's like, take this gun. I can't take it anymore.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
He just shot up a sign and, like...
Yeah. And, like, this kid, like, every line he has is, like, so... Oops. It's, like, so, like, flat. Like, he's just, like... Because at one point he yells at, like, Pat Hingle, and he's like, you know, you're a real shithead. But it's just, like, so monotone.
Oh, like, all the people, too, like, the Bible salesman guy that gets, like, killed or thrown into the creek.
Mm-hmm.
And then he waits, like, 5 hours before he starts screaming, and they're like, that's that Bible salesman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, him. And then, the newlyweds, the woman, the latest newlyweds character, that's
Yardley Smith.
Yes, Lisa Simpson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at least good to see she found something to do after.
There was a comment that was funny that because I was watching it while Steph was there. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I have to pee. And she's like, can I watch? And Steph's like, that's the exact uncomfortable thing I would say to you, Justin. I was like, I know, I know.
Yeah, it's a weird, and it was hard for me, like, in this film to...
And how come cars weren't affected, just trucks?
Yeah, that is true.
But lawnmowers and sprinklers and
Coke machines. Yeah, because they're driving around in their
cars.
Yeah.
But not cars. Cars, like, were not affected.
You would think that would be part of that. Yeah, I don't... It's weird, because, like, the trucks are circling the truck stop.
It's carist. It's against cars.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe that's how this is, like, a prequel to the Cars universe. Somehow the car's just late to this game.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe the cars take over, and then you get cars.
Yeah.
Although there are trucks in that, too. Maybe they only keep the good trucks around.
Yeah, they get rid of the other ones. They domesticate the good trucks.
Yeah, I'm glad we figured that out.
Maximum Overdrive is a prequel to Cars.
One of the things I really, really hate in movies, and it's usually biopics, is I hate when you get to the end of the movie, and it's just, this is what happened. This is in paragraphs. I never like that, ever. Tell the story that you can tell that's confined to what you're seeing. But for Stephen King, if for some reason, in a story that's not even real, they had to have this, like, dumb, like, catch-up.
Yeah, at the end, it's like, it's so weird at the end, because they're like, oh, yeah, the Earth passed through the tail of the comet, like, when it's supposed to, and then a UFO was shot down by a Russian satellite.
Yeah, a UFO was shot down by a Russian satellite, which made no sense at all, because nothing was UFO ever.
Yeah.
And then it was like, it ends with this really weird line where it's like, the survivors are still survivors.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, that, so they're still alive, I guess.
I guess, yeah. But yeah, this one was, like, hard for me to, like, even pay attention to it, because it's so, like, listless, I guess. Like, there's no ever sense of tension. And the characters, like, they're all, like, pretty flat archetypes. And it's...
And some of it is funny, too. Like, when... Is it, like, the only gas station in the world because all the trucks line up to get gas?
Yeah, yeah. That's weird because, like, the trucks are, like, circling, trying to kill these people, but then they run out of gas and they want the people to fill them up. And... Yeah, but yeah, they...
I still never understood how they could hear them, because they're like, we don't have any electricity, and electricity, like, immediately comes on.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot, like, why... Yeah, how they could hear them or why they were so...
Emilio Estevez sasses them as he walks by the machine gun thing.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what he said. Was he talking about going to the bathroom or something?
I think.
It was, like, something you wouldn't understand as a machine.
Yeah, he gets a lot
like,
of those,
like... that's the machine gun. Don't talk to the machine gun that way.
Does, like, generic 80s action hero...
Now, if it could be remade, the perfect director would definitely be Michael Bay. Because he nailed Transformers, so just make an evil Transformers movie.
Without robots, yeah.
No transforming, just the cars moving without people in them.
Yeah, and get Mark Wahlberg in it, and...
I did like the creepy ice cream truck, but it didn't ever pay off in that movie.
Yeah, I remember thinking that, too. I'm like, oh, that could be kind of interesting. Like, that seems like something Rob King's alley, this evil kind of creepy ice cream truck. But
that would have maybe been a cooler opening, because I didn't really like the book all the way, but the beginning of the book Cell, I thought was really, really cool. Yeah. How it just complete chaos in one instant.
Yeah.
And, I think that would have been great to have, like, kids waiting for ice cream. I mean, he kills kids anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, like, the bridge scene where they had that dumb, like, you idiot, you killed a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy working the bridge, he's like, I never touched the button.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was more idyllic. Because there's something, like, so innocent and so cute about kids, you know, waiting for the ice cream man. You know, you see it on the street corner. Like, you know, when they hear the music, they get excited and run outside. You know, if you take that scene and turn it, make it
creepy dark, or awful.
Yeah. Yeah, dark and disturbing. Like, I feel like that would have been one hell of a much better beginning than a confused Stephen King staring at an ATM yelling at an off-screen wife that is calling him an asshole.
And the bridge scene's really weird, too, because as horrific as it is, AC/DC makes it, like, cool or something.
Yeah, and that's my issue with the AC/DC score is, like, you can... There are moments in cinema, it's like a fine line to walk where you can play... like disconnected music from whatever's going on the screen, where you could play like happy music when something terrible's happening. But this movie, all the way, is just like people dying, and we're gonna be jamming to AC/DC.
There was a part too where they're trying to talk, and AC/DC was singing over the people talking.
Yeah.
Emilio Estevez was trying to say something, and you should let Emilio Estevez say what he needs to say.
Mm-hmm.
And AC/DC was like, ah. I'm like, why are they singing? Because you know they scored it. You know they watched the movie and scored it, like a real score.
I feel like this is like, it's like you're watching like a first-time film student's project. You know, Stephen King has never directed a film before, and you know, the characters aren't good because he's never made a movie before, and the score is drowning out the actors. He doesn't know about sound design.
I kind of wish that he would have tried it a few more times, because even as bad as it is, I feel like with the people that he was friends with, like Romero and stuff, I feel like he could have talked them into like how to do it more subtly and how to be better at it.
Yeah, I think I think filmmaking, I don't think anyone can pick it, but I think if you want to learn, like, you can learn, and if you work at it, you can get better. And I feel like, if he hung out with Romero and guys like that, I feel like he could definitely have picked up a thing or two and maybe, you know, perfected himself. And I feel like, you know, we were talking about his coke problem. I also feel like, you know, his drug addiction may have...
Yeah, that coke machine was a big problem.
Yeah, it's a metaphor for King's addiction. But I feel like addiction hurt him a lot in this film, and he readily admits nowadays that it's a pretty terrible movie. So I feel like, you know, he just decided to not...
There is a lot of love for the movie, and I don't know if it's from other cokeheads. I don't really know where it comes from, because I actually would have a ton of people coming into the video store being like, Maximum Overdrive. Like, do you remember that movie? Or is it like a good, fond memory of like just the Green Goblin truck or something?
Because I know a lot of people, I see in horror circles and stuff, they always talk about the Green Goblin truck. And that is easily the most memorable part of this movie, but it's...
cheating. It's taking it from a very memorable comic book.
Yeah. You're preying on, like, people's, their love of comic books, especially something you associate with your childhood, like the Green Goblin. And, yeah, I think the Green Goblin truck is awesome, but I also love the comic book design of Green Goblin, so this is probably...
That's why he didn't go smashing through anything, because he didn't want to screw up his face.
Yeah. I guess someone found it, like, the truck head, the front of it, had, like, kind of fallen in disrepair, and it was, like... lost, and someone found it and completely restored it, and they like have it on a truck now and stuff, so it's out there somewhere.
That's cool. I like that kind of stuff. I watched the thing where they were restoring the Ecto-1, like the original Ecto-1.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Dan Aykroyd from memory like remembers all the tiny little details about it, so they rebuilt the original from his memory. That's pretty cool.
Holy shit. Well, good for Dan Aykroyd. But yeah, it's crazy, like, with Hollywood props stuff, like how easily stuff like that gets discarded, because I remember when I was in L.A. this past spring, there was a thrift store that sold old movie costumes, and not, like, it wasn't, like, you know, anything fancy, it was just, like, probably stuff actors or extras wore that were sitting around the studio back lot. They gave it to this thrift store. But if you go in, they have, like, props, they have, like, legit costumes on display in this thrift store on Magnolia Boulevard. And they're not for sale, but they're just there. And they had, like, the suit of armor from one of Skeletor's henchmen from the He-Man movie. They had one of the Scream costumes. They had the costumes from Van Helsing. They had, I don't know if you've ever seen A Return to Oz, but there's this moose head called the Gump. They had the Gump, like, mounted on their wall. And it's just, like, it's weird how, like, stuff like that somehow, like, disappears and it ends up in some random spot.
Yeah, because you would think, like, okay, maybe the problem is holding on to it for too long.
Mm-hmm.
They know after a couple years it could be popular and they might be able to make something off of it, like an auction.
Mm-hmm.
Although, then again, in modern times, the auction, they could do them online. They could sell them all anywhere across the United States or the world, for that matter. And back then, you advertise it, and it's pretty much just going to be people that are around L.A.
Yeah.
That probably don't give a fuck about the Return to Oz.
Yeah. Or, like, you know, Van Helsing was a flop, so they probably had their extra costumes. Like, yeah, here, do whatever you want of them. Or maybe they auctioned them and this place bought it, you know.
For nothing, yeah. Yeah.
And, like, especially, you know, I'm a big He-Man fan. And so I saw, like, you know, the Skeletor Stormtrooper costume. I'm like, I must have this. And it's on display, and it's, like, not for sale. Do not touch. I'm like, shit. Like, I would have showed out for that thing. It's because I'm like, I'm just that big of a fan. But
yeah. And you would be wearing it on the podcast.
Yeah, I'd be sitting here right now dressed like one of Skeletor Stormtroopers.
So, our original plan was to do Bad King.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we nailed it with the worst, probably, Maximum Overdrive, which is sadly the only film directed by Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
And I vaguely remembered from a child watching Cat's Eye. And I've seen Cat's Eye a lot. And I probably have not watched Cat's Eye in maybe 10 years. And I was actually surprised how it wasn't nearly as awful as I remembered it to be honest with you. Most of it was kind of compelling for the most part. Besides, the goofiest thing that I can remember of Cat's Eye is the police song. Like, the police song that keeps coming back.
Oh, yeah, I'll be watching you.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Cat's Eye, I was surprised by it, because I'd never heard of it before you told me about it, and I looked it up. And, you know, it's Cat's Eye is it's an anthology. It's three stories all connected by this cat, like, who... This is not exactly... He only really participates in the final story, but is more of an observer, kind of, in the first two stories.
Small little parts in part one and two.
Yeah.
He's used in the first part as a... to show what could happen. Mm-hmm. The second one, he's a part of a bet.
Yeah.
And the third one, he's pretty much the protagonist.
The main character.
The cat becomes the protagonist by the end.
And, like, the wraparound was what confused me. So, because, you know, when you first meet the cat, it's, like, in New York, and it's young Drew Barrymore. This is made in the 85, so Drew Barrymore was, you know, a child. And this cat sees, like, a mannequin in a window, and sees Drew Barrymore's face asking it to help her. And it sees it one more time after the first... It sees Drew Barrymore's face again later on. And I assumed, like, this cat had a pre-existing relationship with Drew Barrymore, and it was, like, trying to get back to her. Like, it was his master's, it's a he-cat. But at the third story, it meets Drew Barrymore, and she doesn't seem to have ever met this cat before, so I guess this cat was, like...
It's a psychic
cat. Yeah, so, like, yeah, I guess it was, like...
Clearly, it's a psychic cat, James, but I don't understand why you're not loving this.
I guess all cats are psychic, but yeah, I guess this cat had precognition that this girl would need his help, and it traveled across America to get to this girl, but we'll get to it, because I have a lot to say about that final story.
Okay, but let's go with the first story. The first story is James Wood... Woods wants to stop smoking cigarettes, and he basically finds a mafia-based, what would you call it, program.
Yeah, I guess it's a program to help you quit smoking, but by the most extreme way possible, where they threaten to destroy your loved ones if you keep smoking.
And the comedy in it, it's a little weird, too, because the guy... The main character, the main character.
Yeah, I don't remember his name.
He's sitting in the waiting room, and he knows that something really, really bad happened to the guy that was waiting in the waiting room with him and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So, he kind of has some red flags, but that doesn't stop him from going in and talking it out with, like, the owner of who runs this mob slash... what was it called?
I guess we'll say maybe like a smoker's rehab.
Like a rehab of some sort. And he threatens basically that if you start smoking, we're going to electrocute your wife, which they show of them electrocuting the cat, which I'd be kind of impressed if they didn't actually really hurt a cat, because I have no idea how they had all the sparks in that cat that's clearly distressed, like, running all around in that room.
That's what I thought, too. I'm like, how did they do this?
They're, like, legit electrocuting a cat, probably, in the movie.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I'm like, how did they do this without injuring a cat?
But it gets really funny, because there's a scene where James finds that there is a... He goes to his room, and he's going to get a cigarette out of his office. And this door creaks open, his closet door... And he goes to look, and he doesn't see anybody in there, and he throws something back in. You hear the guy go, "Oh!"
Yeah, like really, really cheesy, like, "Ugh."
Yeah.
And I guess we should add that this organization told him that, like, they will be watching him at any moment, even when he thinks he's not being watched, and he's trying to sneak a cigarette in his study.
And there's clearly somebody in his house, and he's all disturbed because earlier they wanted to know where his daughter went to school, and he's like, that's not important, but they follow him to the school. And there's a crazy scene where he ends up going to this party.
Oh my god, that scene.
And it's so funny because before it gets ridiculous and he's just kind of, I assume, imagining things because he's so addicted to cigarettes. There is so much smoke in this person's house because literally every person is smoking. It looks like a fog machine was just turned on.
Everyone's smoking. Then his buddy's like, have a cigarette. He's like, no, I quit. And his buddy's like, oh, come. Like, he's high pressuring James Woods having a cigarette. And at the moment, I thought, like, wait, am I watching, like, a Dare video? Like, that's what it brought me back to, like, my middle school days where they're showing you videos of, like, oh, your friends are going to be pressuring you, and you got to say no because everyone's smoking. And
it gets so funny, too, because he's, like, smoke's coming out of his ears. He's got, like, 20 cigarettes that he's all smoking at the same time.
There's, like, giant cartons of cigarettes walking by.
Then the police song starts playing, and the mob guy comes dressed like an Elvis-type person down the stairs and starts singing the song to the main character.
The weird part is when a waiter walks by and he has Eggs Benedict, like, forming a face on the tray, and then, like, the Eggs Benedict has, like, eyes, and it's watching James. And I'm watching it, and, like, I'm not a smoker, but I'm like, I don't think you hallucinate.
When there's giant cigarette cartons dancing around, too. Yeah.
And then there's, like, that picture that's watching him, and the picture, like, shoots out smoke from his nose. It is the weirdest scene.
I think this is probably the worst part of the whole movie, where I kind of remembered it being bad. And then as you move into, like, the other stories, I didn't really think it was as bad as, like, this scene.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of, even as ridiculous as this is, they, he ends up smoking, and they end up getting his wife and shocker and stuff. And then it cuts to months later, or a month later, or maybe weeks, where things are going well for him. And the mob guy ends up talking about, like, he makes a joke about, we won't kill him, we'll just take your wife's pinky finger if you put on more weight.
Yeah, because they mentioned that he'd put on weight since he quit smoking, and they tell him to lose 8 pounds. And, yeah, he's like, but he's joking with them. He's like, oh, what, you'll kill my wife, huh? And they're like, no, we'll just take your pinky finger.
And they laugh it off.
Yeah, James Woods, like, laughs it off after all he's been through. He's just like, oh, you, and then, like, walks out. And that takes us to the final button there.
There's a dinner scene where they're with other people in the smoking program, and they cheer to the smoking program, and the wife of the one guy is missing the pinky finger.
Yeah.
And it kind of is, like, I guess a cool ending overall to the story that's, it should be somewhat grounded, but they definitely went without being grounded. Like, it'd be interesting to see this story without the weird fantasies and stuff. Just, like, have a guy that's just, maybe don't start it as crazy.
Yeah.
And, or make it less iffy, like it's a fight with the wife that he sees in the waiting room. And then, like, they threaten him after he signed the deal, and then it's more like, because they do have, like, some weird scenes, or maybe clever. I don't know if it's weird or clever, where there's a guy jogging, and they do a close-up of his feet where he's wearing, like, dress shoes and dress socks to show that he is he's part of the mafia. He's not he's not just a random jogger.
Now, I know King did the screenplay for this. Are any of these based on short stories of his, or are these all written for this film?
As far as I know, I don't think any of them were. And if they were, maybe, like, one. I feel like the second story feels like something that he would have written prior to.
Yeah, the second one really feels like a King's short story. More so than the others.
The second story, we're introduced to a guy that loves to gamble. He gambles all the time. And he opens up his story by gambling on the cat, if the cat can make it across the street without getting killed. With like a random person of his, friend or something of his.
And the first story took place in New York. This takes place in Atlantic City. But yeah, they're gambling whether or not the cat can cross the street safely. And I should add that every time people in this film see the cat, they'll act like they've never seen a cat before. They're like, oh, look, a cat. But yeah, he gambles it in. This is where I thought it was going, because, like, the cat makes it across safely, but the film, like, doesn't slow-mo. It makes it seem like the guy, like the gambler, like he has some ability to like change luck in his favor or something, but it never really goes into that.
Oh, there's a car pile up for this cat running across the street that is completely ignored by like anybody. Like, you never see anybody running towards the cars. Like, oh my god, the guy just gets in his car. Like, it seems very Twilight Zone-ish where the guy's just like no care in the world that this just happened. And but he does mention earlier that his wife's running off with some tennis player. And they capture the tennis player, and the gambler obviously makes a bet with the tennis player, which I think is maybe the most, one of the more interesting King stories. Maybe the most interesting one in this movie.
Yeah, I'd probably say so.
The guy, the gambler tells the guy that's cheating, with his wife, I guess, I don't know how to phrase that, that he has two options. They planted a bunch of drugs in his car so he could go to jail for a long time. Or he can crawl around the building.
Yeah.
On the ledge of this tall Atlantic City condo of some sort.
Yeah, he lives on like the top floor of like some high rise in Atlantic City.
If he walks around the entire thing without falling off, then he'll give him, how much money was it? A lot of money, the woman, and he can go for free or something like that. So, and I honestly felt like when you watched him going around the building, there was a, I was getting very anxious watching it. Like, there's a few times where, like, I felt like it seemed very realistic up high where he was at. Maybe not the shots where, like, it looked, where he looked down, but some of them where he just kind of, like, kind of lost his balance.
Yeah, it was pretty intense, like, the way the gambler's, like, fucking with him, where he's, like, spraying him with water or, like,
you starts hitting him with a robe, like, right off the bat.
But the one part that lost me is when, like, the tennis player, the guy from Airplane, the main guy.
That's all I know him from is Airplane.
Airplane, and he's the dad in Homeward Bound. That's where I... But he's, like, on the ledge, and there's, like, this bird.
Oh, the pigeon from hell.
Yeah, the pigeon from hell. It was, like, pecking him in, like, the shin, and he's, like, kicking at it, and it's not going away, and, like... Other, unless it's a Hitchcock film, like, no pigeon hates people that much.
It keeps pecking at him in the exact same spot, so you know how bad that, like, hurts.
Yeah, and, like, is drawing blood, and he, like, gets into, like, an alcove and, like, kicks it. But this pigeon spends, like, 5 minutes just attacking this guy's shin.
Yeah, well, yeah, the guy's resting, and... the gambler up on the roof now has a fire hose.
Yeah.
And he's spraying the guy, which I would imagine maybe one of the kind of misses with spraying the guy is maybe he's slippery or something.
Yeah, well, I guess he sprays him, tells him to keep moving, but then he says, like, that wasn't full power. If it's not full power, we'll just shoot him right off.
His henchman's funny, too, because he has, like, this tough henchman, but it's more like just a really fat guy.
Yeah.
Which is really funny because he's got the suspenders and he's just like, he's always eating and he has him at the window and he like, the guy falls and it looks like he falls off the building, but he just fell down to like, he just slid down to the next ledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which he crawls back up, but they don't really show that. But I also like too, before he gets all the way around the building. So spoiler alert, the guy gets all the way around the building. You hear the gambler talking to the other henchman. He's like, when I say this phrase, you come in. And the guy's like, this phrase? He's like, no, this phrase. And it's like trying to like make a cool entrance sort of thing. And I guess I won't ruin exactly what happens, but I'm sure you can imagine what happens to the gambler.
Yeah. It's a very King. And it's a very... It reminded me of like a classic King short story, but also very much of like a Tales from the Crypt episode. Where, like, you know, this guy does a terrible thing and then, like, it's revisited back on him. Like, minus the cat, this could easily, I think, be, like, an episode of Tales from Crypt or a comic book, an old EC comic book done in that style. And I think that's why I liked this story a lot more than the first James Woods story.
And I'm kind of fine with the last story, too, as funny as it, more funny as it is. It's a smoking story that I think is, like, what kind of gives all three of them, like, that bad name.
Yeah.
But you find out, it takes the third story to be like, what the fuck does Drew Barrymore have to do with this cat? You find out very early on, he goes, this little girl, he's got to protect this little girl from something. Which, it starts, like, with, like, a Halloween movie. where it's clearly something very small and out of breath running around.
Yeah.
It's like a troll. Mm-hmm. There's this troll that wants to steal the breath of Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, so the cat has to get to this house and protect Drew Barrymore from this troll who's trying to steal her breath. But meanwhile, Drew Barrymore's mom in this movie has, like, a massive hate boner for cats, and it is, like, because Drew Barrymore finds the cat and names him General and wants to take him in. And Drew Barrymore's mom's like, no, cats steal little girls' breath and, like, won't let the cat in the house.
I think it's the dad that says that. She's like, thanks for helping us out. But she has a little bird, and they're afraid that General's going to eat it.
Yeah.
So, of course, it gets killed by the troll, and the cat gets blamed for it.
Yeah.
And they try to... She's an evil person that takes this cat to, a, like, probably a kill shelter.
Yeah, yeah. Drew Barrymore's mom tricks the cat, takes it to a shelter, and the troll... The troll is... I loved it. This troll is adorable. Like, if I could... if I could adopt this troll...
I don't know if it was adorable. It was kind of really creepy, but... It was wearing a weird costume.
It's wearing this weird... It has, like, a tiny little knife, and it, like... This troll already is, like, kind of bad, because it's always, like, tripping and stuff, and, like, messing up, and it's clearly just trying its best.
But, it's, like, Jess... And it's funny, too, because it's dressed like a little jester with bells.
Yeah, it has bells.
But when it's running around in the beginning, it never makes a bell sound.
Yeah, there are no bells, but, but, yeah, this is all leading to, the cat's trying to race back to Drew Barrymore's house, where... Meanwhile, the troll has come off a hole in the wall that it can make a hole, but also can, like, magically close it behind it.
Yeah.
But,
which makes sense, because if it's a mythical beast of some sort,
then
it has to be, if it's been around for years, it has to be able to hide itself somehow.
Yeah. But, so the cat's running to try and save her, and, a troll is trying to steal Drew Barrymore's breath, and, yeah.
You didn't think you were ever going to be saying this on the podcast.
Yeah, I never thought I would, no, but the cat shows up in the nick of time, and what results might be, like, possibly, like, the cutest fight scene of all time. You get this cat troll fight scene, which...
The troll's all bouncing around, and then, like, he's grabbing on the balloons, and the cat's about to get him, and it's pawing at him.
Yeah, it's like pawing at this troll hanging from balloons, and then, like... The troll's trying to run through the hole it made, but, like, the cat knocks a children's book down in front of the hole, which, apparently, despite the troll having magic powers to close this hole behind it, like, it's stymied by this children's book.
Apparently can only open up a hole in certain spots on the wall.
Yeah, my favorite part is, like, when the cat's chasing it, and the troll effects is clearly a guy in a costume in, like, a giant set.
Yeah,
which I love. And, like, this cat's chasing it, and it's, like, picking up children's crayons and throwing it, like, spears at the cat. Like, I was way more entertained by this scene than I've been by most modern cinema. Like, I don't know why. Like, I was so into this.
Yeah, it's funny. And then the parents are locked out of the bedroom, and they hear all this crashing and violence and stuff going on. And they can't get the door open because there's a rubber door stop in the front of the door.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I imagine they think the cat's in there killing their kid or something.
Yeah, and Drew Barrymore is, like, cheering on the cat.
And anything she tells the cat to do, the cat does.
Yeah, yeah. The cat is super intense because, like, at the end, the troll falls onto, like, a record player, and a cat turns on the record player and is spinning around. I'll be watching you. Well, the troll's on,
yeah,
and Drew Barrymore is telling the cat to make it go faster, so the cat keeps turning up the speed on the record player and sends the troll flying into a fan that chops it up into little pieces.
And parents bust in the door right after that, because
yeah.
that's their timing.
Yeah, and they see the remains of the troll and decide to accept the cat into their home.
And there's this follow-up scene, which... Almost, I don't know, every time I watch it, it feels like it could go the complete opposite way.
Yeah, that's where I thought they were going with this, like...
The cat sneaks into the bedroom of the parents where the Drew Barrymore's sleeping between, and the cat goes right up to her face.
Yeah, and that's where I thought, I'm like, oh, is this going to get a super dark ending where you find out the cat just wanted to, like, kill this girl herself? Cat, like, licks her face.
Yeah,
She wakes up and, like, smiles at it.
Yeah, it has, like, and this weird fantasy, like, sound of Drew Barrymore being like, ah, cat. Like, it's weird. Like, they make it echo and seem like some fantasy movie of some sort.
Yeah.
Oh, we have a cat.
Speaking
now.
Of cat, here's my cat, Tesla. She decided to crash our
cat's eye.
Our podcast proceedings here.
She'll probably be like, she'll probably end the podcast, hit the stop button.
Yeah. She likes walking on computers, so we should move her.
So we're good.
But yeah.
So overall, I guess I surprised you with Cat's Eye. Yeah. I'm kind of glad that we watched it because I honestly kind of wrote it off a long time ago. And honestly, I think it's kind of enjoyable. I definitely recommend people watch it if they haven't
seen
it.
Yeah, it's kind of, like I said, it's kind of endearing and just really ridiculous. You know, of all these stories, like the third one definitely has a more fantastical element that I don't think fits with the other two.
There's like no supernatural anything in the first two.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden you get
there's a goddamn troll.
This troll, yeah. But I mean, like that one like stuck out with me because of that. But I'm also a cat person, so I love cats. But no cat would ever be this motivated to help another living thing ever.
I think it's kind of impressive too for everything they get this cat to do in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to get it to walk. And it seems like it's the same cat. I mean, I don't know how many cats they trained, but we all know how hard it is. And well, at least the people in filmmaking know how hard it is to control an animal the way that you want it to.
Yeah, and I thought that too. Like, you know, dogs, you can kind of train, but cats are a lot more difficult. Like, it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience to train a cat. But it seems that they're able to get this cat to do whatever they wanted.
Now, I have a cat, Dustin Hoffman, who I hate. He tries to kill me. He tries to break my stuff. And I watched this movie and I was like, why can't I have this cat? General's so much nicer than my cat.
Yeah, I was thinking because, like, you know, I love Tesla, my cat, but if there was a troll trying to kill me, Tesla would run the opposite way. Like, I'd be dead. It'd take my breath.
Yeah, we got selfish cats. We don't have hero cats.
Yeah, and that's probably why I love Tesla, because she's a selfish little bitch. And she's, you know, because of that, she's low maintenance, but yeah, this also really reminded me of, did you ever see Bad Moon, made in the 90s?
No.
It's a werewolf film, but it's all told from a dog. The dog is the main character, where this guy comes to live with his sister and her son, and they have a dog, like a German Shepherd named Thor, and this guy's a werewolf. And the only one that figures it out is the dog. And, like, everything the werewolf's doing, the dog is getting blamed. And, like, the ending is just like the ending of Cat's Eye, where you know, like, the guy's turned to a werewolf and he's going after his family, and the dog who's been put into a shelter escapes the shelter and is running across the city to get back in time to save the family. And it reminded me just of that, except, you know, this has a cat and that's a dog.
Yeah, so I think the idea of this episode was to do bad Stephen King, and I think Maximum Overdrive reinforced everything I hated about it. It definitely didn't change my mind. And this, Cat's Eye, I was like, for some reason I find myself enjoying Cat's Eye way more than I thought I was. I thought for sure, like, it's cheesy, it's not that great, it's not like one of the things I ever hear anybody talking about, but I'd recommend Cat's Eye, I guess.
Yeah, it's a typical 80s movie for sure, but I think it's worth a watch. It's definitely a very interesting movie. But, yeah, Maximum Overdrive is still terrible. And will probably always be.
So we got two more King episodes coming up. I would say one really good King and one maybe, like, torn King. Torn between people that watch it.
Yeah, I'm very interested. I'm very excited for that one, for our conversation. And that one also figures into Bad King, kind of.
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, from my point, because I guess, should we spoil it, or?
No.
I'll talk about it. I've been wanting to talk about this forever, but I've been saving it for that episode, but.
It might be more of a debate, but.
Yeah, it's more of a debate, but my introduction to this particular King adaptation was the worst adaptation of it that happened later.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. That's a good tease. There are so many multiple adaptations of certain things that.
Yeah.
There you go.
But yeah, thanks for listening, guys. And as always, check, you know, subscribe us, like us, leave us reviews.
Yeah, I'm at JJMorgan19 on Twitter. You can send me some messages or don't.
Yeah.
And we appreciate our pod people.
Yeah, thanks for listening, pod people. And I'm at James Reinhardt on Twitter. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Love Cinema Pod, and on Facebook as well.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, guys.